Fossils and Fiction, a show about ancient life, paleontology, and the stories we tell. The show is produced by me, Travis Holland, on Wiradjuri country with the support of Charles Sturt University. Enjoy! Welcome to Fossils and Fiction for 2024. It's been a long, hot Australian summer, and I've been working hard to bring new podcast episodes to life. In this first episode of the year, I've gotten my hands on a copy of a new academic book all about Jurassic Park. Funnily enough, it is called the Jurassic Park Book. This is the first episode in a two-part series speaking with contributors to the book. First up, we have the editor, Dr. Matt Melia from Kingston University in the UK, and Peter Kramer from De Montfort University, also in the UK. In future episodes, I will have another couple of contributors, but it may be a few weeks down the line. In the meantime, enjoy this one and more to come.
I am Matt Melia. I'm a senior lecturer at Kingston University in sort of film, media, and English Lit.
The Jurassic Park book is a comprehensive study of this landmark film 30 years after its release. What motivated you to put together the work?
In the sort of short term, I suppose, it was a sequel to the Jaws book. It came out, I think, in 2020 from Bloomsbury, sort of edited collection on Jaws. But really, it kind of stems from my own sort of personal love of the film, my own sort of history with it. It's a film which had a really big impact on me. I saw it on its opening night back in 1993 at a cinema in Waterloo, Crosby, on Merseyside in the UK. A cinema called the Plaza Cinema. It's now a community cinema. It's really, really great place. So give a bit of a shout out to that. But it was a really sort of big moment in my sort of cinema going life, I suppose. The first big event movie which I'd sort of experienced at that time. I was probably about 14, 15, something like that. So it had a big impact on me, really. I remember sort of, and I can mention this in the book, turning up at the cinema and the queue being all the way down the street and sort of round the corner into the next street. I hadn't seen anything like it. So it was pretty amazing. I suppose kind of for people like me who are that little bit too young for both Jaws and Star Wars the first time round, this was our version of that. So yeah, that was kind of that was important for me because it was I sort of enjoyed getting into that really and sort of remembering that moment. But also I think kind of we should celebrate kind of popular cinema. I think a lot of attention is paid to, you know, important art films or, you know, what have you. And that's great. But I think kind of there is a movement, there is a moment at the minute where popular cinema is coming more into focus. Mm-hmm. I think there's a nostalgia, I think, for the 1990s, which the book kind of segues with as well. For instance, there's been a recent book published, on the 30 years of the X-Files, which kind of Jurassic Park is sort of concurrent with. So I think that's really interesting. There's a kind of moment which we wanted to hit for that 30th anniversary. The book is a sort of natural progression as well from the Jaws book, which we, as I said, we published in 2020. I edited that with a colleague. I did this one sort of by myself, but it started off as a sort of mutual project between us, and then he stepped back and I sort of took it over. I'm currently working on a third book, or putting a proposal together for a third book on E.T. So, because what I'd like to do is have a trilogy of books on Spielberg's three big blockbusters, and see where it goes from there. So we've done the Jaws book as a kind of natural progression, the Jurassic Park was as a book as a kind of natural progression to the from the Jaws book, I suppose. I think as well, while other major moments of popular cinema have sort of captured the imagination and sort of been celebrated in sort of critical writing, sort of notably Star Wars, for instance, there's been precious little work actually dedicated to Jurassic Park or to Jaws, for that matter, and nothing really written around E.T. And I think that's because, and Linda Ruth Williams, Professor Linda Ruth Williams, sort of mentions this in her forward to the book, Spielberg wasn't really taken seriously as someone to be studied due to the sort of spectacular, popular, mainstream nature of the work. He was seen as a kind of offshoot of that kind of American New Wave of the 1970s, and sort of leading cinema kind of out of the New Wave into this new era of the blockbuster. I think he'd suffered from criticisms of being overly sentimental and family oriented, that sort of thing. But I think kind of that's misleading, because there's a real darkness to Spielberg's work.
Yeah, it would be a mistake just to say that Spielberg is family oriented, because he does have these kinds of horror elements laced through most of his films, and Jurassic Park's a great example of that. But
absolutely,
what really captures your attention about Spielberg, if this is your sort of second of hopefully three books focused on his work, what brings you back to him? Is it that? Is it repositioning his role in culture or in cinema history there? Or
yeah,
is there something about his work?
I think that's really important. People like Peter Kramer have been sort of repositioning Spielberg and sort of, celebrating kind of blockbuster cinema and sort of writing critically about blockbuster cinema in really interesting ways. But I think I think it is important to sort of bring him, reposition him as a sort of major auteur, if you like, of cinema, and sort of in doing so highlight the importance of popular cinema. I think that's the because that's what brings us together, right? That's what brings people together.
Yeah. It's a bit of a mistake from critics and the Academy to ignore the things that most people want to engage with. I think it can be problematic to ignore something just because it's popular, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, so I was born in 1978. So I've not known a world without Steven Spielberg. He sort of defines the popular cinematic experience for me anyway. So I've loved Spielberg's films since I was a kid. I mean, he's synonymous not just with popular cinema, but with cinema itself. Spielberg invented a kind of new visual grammar for popular cinema, particularly in the way that he uses light, for instance, which has been sort of discussed by various people. And I think as well, in an era when the way we watch films has been so varied and diversified, films are destined for streaming services or mobile devices, Spielberg's cinema remains kind of resolutely cinematic. The place to watch it is in the cinema. They're sort of love letters to cinema and the cinematic experience itself. I don't know if you saw The Fablemans recently, but that was all about, his own love of cinema. It was a kind of semi-autobiographical film about his own relationship with cinema and his family. But I think kind of Jurassic Park is kind of testament to this kind of commentary on cinema. I mean, it's been discussed before, but that moment in the film where they arrive in Jurassic Park and encounter the Brachiosaurus eating from the top of the tree, that's a really important moment, because I think what he's doing there is he's kind of filtering our experience. Our own astonishment at the kind of visual effects that are being implemented by ILM there, you know, this this great spectacle, you know, our sort of awe at the spectacle of cinema is kind of is being sort of filtered to the image on screen.
What was maybe interesting about that shot is you're right, of course, it was a digital shot, but it was filmed as if it was a practical shot with that kind of forced perspective angle. You're looking at the brachiosaur from the human perspective to make it look like a truly magnificent or giant creature. Yeah. And that probably speaks to that grandeur that he sort of captured in Jurassic Park with all of the larger dinosaurs, certainly. So,
no, absolutely. And I think what's interesting as well, and is that if you take somebody's somebody like Tom Gunning, who writes about early cinema and what he calls the cinema of attractions, that moment in the sort of the early days of the evolution of, you know, cinematic technology and sort of viewing. And he says, you know, people would go to marvel at the processes by which the image appears, you know, the technology. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jurassic Park is really rooted back in that early kind of cinema of attractions, you know, particularly in that moment, because it comes out, you know, it's a pivotal moment for digital effects. There's only, I think, 6 minutes of the actual film that are CGI.
Yeah.
The rest is animatronic, so it's kind of seamlessly merged with these animatronics. I still think it looks really good now, to be honest with you. I was watching it again the other day. But I think
it definitely holds up. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's astonishing to look at for that reason. So I think kind of that sort of kind of going back to the cinema of attractions is a sort of interesting way of thinking about it.
Spielberg really did. He made this film a love letter to a lot of genre films in the same vein, I think. He really played on King Kong and The Old Lost World and all of those kinds of films that he loved as a kid. And sort of tried to reinvoke that same sense of awe as he was filming it. Now, the book, the Jurassic Park book, there's lots of contributions from a wide variety of authors, and I'm going to talk to some of those other authors as well. But you, as the editor, Matt, could you see any major themes or through lines in the book? What really captured the contributors in putting the book together?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I think the contributions from all the authors are really different. You know, they look at it from different ways. I think one of the draws of the book is the sort of diversity of approaches. So there's contributors from film studies, musicologists, adaptation studies, fan studies. Paleontologists are in there, theme park studies. There's a real variety. I was trying to identify some of the kind of through themes. The digital effects are certainly a preoccupation with many of the authors in the book. I think as well, it's relationship to Jaws as mm-hmm. well. It's something that is dealt with across the book as well.
Could you touch on that a little bit? What does Spielberg draw from Jaws, maybe, and use in Jurassic Park?
I mean, for those of us too young to see Jaws first time around, this was sort of our equivalent, I think. Jurassic Park, I think, is Spielberg returning to the kind of Roger Corman-esque creature feature that mm-hmm. he sort of created with Jaws. With Jaws, he was... when he was asked about that film, he said he was basically trying to make a Roger Corman film, which I think is really interesting because both Jaws and Jurassic Park gave birth to lots of like little mini exploitation shark films and dino films. Mm-hmm. Jaws more so than Jurassic Park, but one particular one was in the wake of Jurassic Park, was a film called Carnosaur, which was produced by Roger Corman and stars none other than Diane Ladd, who is Laura Dern's mother. So I thought that was quite an interesting little tidbit. It adapts all sorts of themes from Jaws, I think. So you have kind of man against nature, our own place in the food chain. Both of the films deal with sort of out-of-place prehistoric monsters who threaten a kind of island community governed by naive and hubristic community leaders, so to speak. There are also kind of clear correspondences in character. So you have the kind of heroic everyman in sort of Roy Scheider as Brody and Sam Neill as Alan Grant. You have that kind of trilogy of characters, I think. You know, the Hooper, the sort of nebbish intellectual, is sort of the equivalent of Goldblum's Ian Malcolm. Mm-hmm. You even have a kind of Quint-esque-like character in Muldoon, the dinosaur hunter in the film.
The Great White Hunter, the notion of the Great White Hunter is something I picked up on in a chapter I wrote recently. It's a real trope in the creature films, but it is also one that flows through Jurassic Park and through the whole franchise. Yeah,
I mean, that idea of a kind of white imperialism. Richard Attenborough in this kind of almost like white safari suit as the sort of the great sort of the great explorer, you know, almost like one of those kind of old explorers from history, so that was one thing. But also think kind of in terms of the impact that it had, certainly in terms of merchandising, both of these films kind of had a huge kind of pioneering approach to merchandising, and a massive merchandising blitz. They created a kind of monster mania. One of the interesting things about, and this is written about in the book, certainly in the chapter on merchandising by Tom Livingston, is that when you go into the gift shop in the film, all those products that you see on the shelf are real life products available to buy. They are the merchandising for the film. So I think that's a really interesting kind of almost a bit of self-reflection there, I think. With both films, if you could slap Jurassic Park or Jaws on something, then it would be on there. You know, with Jaws, there was even, Jaws ice cream. Jaws opened the way for the Star Wars merchandising, and that sort of, it also in turn sort of opened the way for the Jurassic Park approach to merchandising. There's tons of kind of thematic and sort of wider ways in which Jaws kind of influences Jurassic Park or prompts Jurassic Park. I think one of the interesting things about Jurassic Park is its sort of awareness of the dangers of kind of neoliberal free market economics and the sort of the all-consuming, devouring sort of capitalism, which it knows it's a part of. Mm-hmm. So there is a kind of self-awareness there,
That's an interesting move that Spielberg often makes, he certainly made in Jurassic Park, right, in making that point. I wonder the extent to which that came from Crichton versus Spielberg, that notion of critiquing the system you're part of. In a sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely there. I mean, when we think about Jurassic Park as a Spielberg film, we also have to think about it as a sort of Michael Crichton film as well. It was important to Crichton as it was to Spielberg. Spielberg hadn't had a hit since 1989 with Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. and his previous two films, which were Always and Hook, had tanked. He'd had a horrible time making Hook. I think in an interview with Mark Kermode, the UK film critic, he once said something like, you know, I look back on Hook and I can't think of anything I like about it. It's the only film I look back on and think, I can't think of anything I like about it.
I think he said the same thing about The Lost World, though. There were, you know, he really found himself mired in trying to tie that story up.
Yeah, he didn't have a happy time making The Lost World either, which is, I think, why he turned over Jurassic Park 3 to Joe Johnson. But just returning to the whole sort of Michael Crichton thing, because I think it's important. Michael Crichton, in the sort of early 90s, well, so from the 70s through to the sort of early 90s, Crichton was quite the figure, really. He'd sort of made the Andromeda Strain at the end of the 70s. He'd become known as both a kind of author and director of these kind of techno thrillers. And he'd made a sort of a name for himself in Hollywood, writing and directing his own work, particularly kind of Coma and Westworld, which is a really interesting film. It's sort of both the Terminator and Jurassic Park have the sort of the framework, the DNA of Westworld within them. Crichton's kind of techno-pessimism, I think, is an important part of the film. It kind of stands with kind of Spielberg's kind of spectacle and his own sort of themes. He'd met Spielberg on the set of ER back in 1989, back while the book was still in its developmental stages. And there'd already been a kind of rush to try and, you know, of directors who wanted to make the, you know, turn it into a film. So people like James Cameron, Tim Burton, Richard Donner, Joe Dante had all shown an interest in it. But what's really interesting, I think, about this is, again, another comparison with Jaws, in which Benchley's novel was kind of bought up by the studio while it was still in the galley stages. So like Jaws, Jurassic Park kind of went into kind of, you know, began its journey from script to screen before the book had even made it onto the shelves. And Oliver Gruner writes in depth about the process of bringing the film to the screen in the book. It's a really detailed chapter. So Jurassic Park was really a kind of a rejuvenation for both Spielberg and Crichton. So in the wake of Jurassic Park, there was a whole rush of Michael Crichton adaptations. Rising Sun with Wesley Snipes and Sean Connery, which is a kind of detective film set in Japan. Mm-hmm. Disclosure, a sort of erotic sexual harassment film. Congo, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, of course, which he sort of wrote immediately afterwards.
And that was his first sequel, right? There'd never been a Crichton sequel before that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It was the first sequel. Crichton had written the first, I think, first couple of script drafts of the film, before it got turned over to Malia Scotch-Marmo and then David Coep, who kind of wrote the final draft of the film. So, I mean, he's in there. He's definitely still in there, you know?
Yeah, he kept his hand in. So, I mean, speaking of Crichton adaptations, I think the one thing I'd like to see an adaptation of is Dragon Teeth, which is this kind of fictionalized telling of the Bone Wars story. So it would be interesting to see how somebody...
Yeah, it's really interesting. Bring that to life. Yeah, because he wrote that, I think he wrote that in the 70s. 70s or 80s, but it didn't get published till after he died. So it was kind of published posthumously. So he does have this kind of interest in sort of paleontology, I think, which tallies with Spielberg as well, I think.
Yeah. I've always seen Jurassic Park as this film that kind of defies genre. It's an action film and an adventure film and a horror film and a creature film and an epic film and an event film, I think you called it, also a family film. How did Spielberg do that? How does he draw those threads together?
I think because... Hang on a second. I think because he himself was a sort of avid consumer of popular cinema. Mm-hmm. You know, as a child, he would make you know short films himself. You know, as a child, as a teenager, he was a consumer of cinema. He was a consumer of genre cinema, and I think you know it goes back to his sort of, I suppose, kind of. His films being a kind of, you know, self-referential sort of love of the, you know, love of the medium, in which he's able to kind of hybridize all these different genres within different films. So, for instance, I mean, with Jurassic Park, I mean, Jennifer Schell in the book writes and identifies. And, you know, we talked about before, kind of lost, you know, the importance of lost world narratives as well, going back to 1924's The Lost World and then sort of King Kong. I think about in my own chapter in the book about the debt to Irwin Allen's disaster movies of the 1970s, mm-hmm. and in which they kind of anticipate the kind of, you know, the disaster renaissance of the 1990s in the run up to the millennium. Horror cinema as well, you know, forms part of the generic matrix of the film, obviously. And I think, again, you can go back to Jaws here. Like if Jaws provides a kind of blueprint not only for the slasher movie, but also for Alien, then so you could sort of compare Jurassic Park to James Cameron's sequel, Aliens, with the sort of the Velociraptors, which is interesting because Cameron had actually wanted to make the film. And had.
I think we would have got a very different film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When he said that, you know, he said in an interview that he tried to buy the book rights, but had been beaten up by a sort of matter of hours to the punch by Spielberg. But in the end, he said, you know, my film certainly wouldn't have been a sort of family film.
I mean, The Lost World leant into the horror a bit more, and then of course, quite famously, Fallen Kingdom did as well. The sequel to Jurassic World, it. Really played on those horror elements in a way none of the other Jurassic films has done, I think.
That whole sort of gothic castle and the creature stomping around on the roof and the storm, almost like the kind of haunted mansion, doesn't it? And it plays in all those gothic tropes. But I think it does so in a much more conscious way. Than Jurassic Park. I think part of the skill of Spielberg's approach is to make a film which is a dinosaur film, but you know if you peel back the layers, it has all these other things kind of beneath the surface, you know, which kind of make up what you're seeing. I think it's interesting that approach. I think as well, I mean, one of the things that he's doing with it is kind of making I kind of like this idea that he's actually making a kind of mega budget B movie, which I think is quite interesting.
You mentioned that it kind of anticipated this renaissance of disaster cinema. What do you mean by that?
So, from the mid-1990s, the disaster movie sort of makes a huge comeback in popular cinema. So you have kind of meteors hurtling towards Earth in various films. You have Deep Impact and Armageddon and all these things. And you have alien invasions, volcanoes popping off all over the place. In the run-up to the sort of turn of the century, there's a whole run of films which are full of this kind of existential dread, existential threat. I mean, cast your mind back now to kind of that moment of the sort of late 90s or mid to late 90s and the sort of run up to the millennium and that sort of the kind of anxiety the sort of existential anxiety of the turn of the century. I mean, remember the millennium bug?
Yeah, so we get these kind of overlapping techno disasters and environmental catastrophes all happening at once in the film. I mean, if you say it kind of anticipates disaster cinema, do you think it also anticipated this kind of emerging environmental cultural issues that, you know, we're kind of obsessed with environmental issues lately?
No, I think it did. And there's an interesting shot in the film where Dennis Nedry is kind of escaping from the Dilophosaurus, or doesn't quite escape, does he? But he drops, the eggs are being carried in this aerosol. Mm-hmm. If you remember at the time, there was the whole anxiety over CFCs.
And
aerosols, and you have that very pointed shot of the aerosol being sort of cast out into the and sort of absorbed into the ground of the park. So I think there's that aspect of it, but also kind of playing with nature as well. The idea of sort of upsetting the natural order of things, hubristic science or hubristic scientists. Disturbing the natural order of our own place in the natural order. In some ways, what Jurassic Park does is set us back down at the bottom of the food chain, and ask us to imagine what that would be like.
And that's a lot of Malcolm's commentary is centered on exactly that, basically saying. Even Wu makes a similar comment. He says something about. To a mouse, a cat is a monster. We're just used to being the cat kind of thing. And it's an interesting comment from someone like Wu.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that famous line that Goldblum makes where he says, your scientists were so preoccupied with it that they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. It's very similar to a line in The Towering Inferno. In which, at the end, the fire chief, played by Steve McQueen, says to Paul Newman's architect, "There's no sure way for us to fight a fire ending above the seventh floor, but you people just keep building them as high as you can." It's not exactly the same, but it's the same kind of thing. And there are interesting. I mean, this is one of the things that kind of prompted me to think about Jurassic Park as a disaster, disaster film, and one which anticipates the sort of the return of the disaster film in from the mid 90s, is that disaster cinema is a kind of large scale experiential cinema in which protagonists have to deal with these kind of threats, usually which come about as a result of man's sort of hubristic tendencies. So you have classic disaster films by the master of disaster, Irwin Allen, The Poseidon Adventure, or The Towering Inferno. And I think Spielberg was indebted to Allen's work. And there are references to The Towering Inferno in particular throughout the film. So that opening helicopter shot where they're sort of flying towards Jurassic Park echoes the helicopter shot from the start of The Towering Inferno. We see the helicopter flying across San Francisco Bay or wherever it is. To the sounds of a stirring John Williams score. Kind of, there's definitely a sort of an awareness there, I think. Not only are there sort of environmental concerns as well, but the idea of AI as well. We're very concerned at the minute about AI and the rise of AI and artificial intelligence. One of the interesting things that I sort of thought about in the book was the idea of the idea of the singularity. Mm-hmm. So back in 1993, the same year that Jurassic Park came out, a guy called Werner Vinge, who was, I think, a computer scientist or a computer theorist or in one of the big American universities, I forget which now, sort of prophesied this idea that within 30 to 50 years, artificial intelligence would develop to such a point that it would overtake and sort of make us all completely irrelevant, which kind of strikes me as incredibly similar to what's going on in Jurassic Park. You have this, these animals are AI, basically. They're created, synthetically created, yeah, sort of intelligent.
They're artificial creatures, right? So
yeah, absolutely. They're Frankenstein, right? I mean, this is another one of the themes that kind of goes through the book as well, I think, is this bringing back Jurassic Park to that kind of central Frankenstein mythos.
This is probably something that, Spielberg, for all the good he did in making the narrative more straightforward and accessible, he also cut away a lot of this fat that actually some of these themes that Crichton really built in.
Yeah.
Malcolm goes on for pages and pages in the novel. At some point.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Clearly you can't have that in the film, but also it gives a lot more juice to some of these debates.
Yeah, it's really stripped back. But I think what's interesting is that you get sections from the book which don't appear in the first film written into the subsequent sequels. Yeah. So you do get those bits. Maybe not the kind of the complexities of sort of mathematical, chaos. I think when they were sort of developing the idea, Spielberg wanted to cut Malcolm's character altogether because he felt that the whole chaos thing was too complex for, a popular audience. But he was convinced to kind of, keep it in, but sort of rein down the... to kind of condense it a little bit, So yeah, but these bit, the bits that don't make it from the novel are sort of incorporated across the next two sequels, particularly Jurassic World as well, which has the bit within the Jurassic Park 3, which has the bit in the aviary, which is brilliant. I love Jurassic Park 3. I think it's great. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's got some beautiful set pieces, and the use of the flying reptiles is fantastic. So,
yeah,
the pterosaurs.
Yeah, because I remember seeing that was my one disappointment. Seeing Jurassic Park, the only thing that disappointed me on my first viewing of it when I went to see it when it was released was there were no flying dinosaurs in it.
Because there is that fantastic scene in the aviary with Grant and the kids trying to make their way through the aviary in the book. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But we got it in Jurassic Park 3, so absolutely. I was just going to say, so we've talked a bit about the book, but the second part of this sort of project was an edited edition of a journal. And you focused on the notion of expanding the Jurassic Park beyond the initial film there, franchising Jurassic Park. What did you touch on, or what did the contributors touch on in that?
So journal? Within that book, really the idea behind the journal was to, I suppose, kind of develop ideas that didn't make it into the book. Or, there wasn't room for in the book that I wanted to include, but also to kind of focus more outwardly on the Jurassic Park franchise itself. It's because, I think kind of as the films have gone on, they've become sort of less and less critically, critically kind of praised. And particularly when it comes to Dominion, the most recent film, which was a huge success, but
well, this is the thing, right? The films are still making $1 billion.
But this is one of the things I kind of wanted to explore with this, this idea of franchise cinema in the sort of modern era. What does it mean in a world of universe, in a world of sort of, what do they call them now? Universes and all that sort of thing, where they just expand and expand and expand, and sort of then you get offshoots and offshoots, offshoots of this film, then offshoots of an offshoot. This is a kind of a fairly new phenomenon, I think, rather than a kind of a franchise in the way we used to kind of understand it. And I wanted to kind of explore how sort of Jurassic Park or the Jurassic Park sort of franchises kind of, you know, franchise kind of stood in relation to these, particularly kind of, you know, post COVID as well, and with Dominion. So that was certainly part of it. In terms of what's in the journal, we have a chapter by Lauren Chochinov called The Inheritance, The Legacy of Ellie Sattler in the Jurassic Park franchise. So it looks at the way that looks at kind of female representation across the Jurassic Park franchise. We've got a chapter on sort of masculinity in Jurassic Park by Gillian Kelly, who sort of looks at the representation of sort of male characters in response to, you know, looking at every man sort of male characters in response to what she calls the kind of masculinity of the 1980s. So people like Schwarzenegger and big stars like Schwarzenegger and Stallone. You have a kind of switch in Jurassic Park to the kind of the everyman, you know, the people like Sam Neill. What else do we have? We've got a couple of chapters on the Jurassic Park video games. So I wanted to have a think about, you know, how Jurassic Park exists outside of Jurassic Park. I wrote a chapter, an article on the unmade Jurassic Park 4, John Sayles's script for that, which kind of appeared online.
Is it? That's the one with the human dinosaur hybrids?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. I think what was interesting about that, though, is the because I'm really interested in sort of the phenomenon of the unmade film, and the, there's a lot of research going on around that at the minute. It was a really interesting book by James Fenwick, which came out, and Kieran Foster and Dave Eldridge, called Shadow Cinema, on the sort of phenomenon of the unmade film.
And they kind of become cult products in their own right, yeah, even though they're never finished.
Yeah, absolutely. But what was really interesting about kind of doing the research for that was the sort of internet archaeology that you have to go through, because there's nothing critically written about this. So you have to go to, you know, the idea which first came up in the sort of the early 2000s, I think. You have to go back to sort of early internet message boards and sort of excavate these kind of old kind of film chat sites and things to get, you know, to piece the timeline together. So that's interesting, because it wasn't just about the unmade film and, you know, how it kind of linked Park to Jurassic World, you know, laid a sort of framework for that. But it's about, you know, how people received these, you know, received films and sort of particularly franchise films in the early days of the internet, and how that changed kind of, I suppose, fan approaches. And then we've got chapter by Catherine Pugh on eco-horror, Jurassic Park and the Devouring Gothic. And then one by Steve Woodbridge, really interesting one, on Dinosaurs and Nazis, the Influence of the Jurassic Park Franchise on Popular and Conspiratorial Versions of History, in which he looks at the way, you know, where and when sort of dinosaurs have cropped up in sort of conspiracy culture. One in particular where the idea that the Nazis wanted to sort of resurrect the dinosaurs as a kind of biological weapon.
Even as someone who indulges in following conspiracy theories every now and then, I've not seen that one, I have to say.
Probably good, yeah.
You also have a chapter from a paleontologist who goes through the science behind the dinosaurs that we see in Jurassic Park. Yeah. Tell me about that chapter.
So it's a really interesting chapter, and I think it sort of stands apart a little bit from the other chapters, in terms of it's written by this paleontologist, Ali Nabavizadeh, I think. But it looks at it takes a kind of franchise-wide look at the dinosaurs, all the dinosaurs from the film, from a kind of scientific and paleontological point of view. It's really kind of packed with, densely packed with kind of facts and sort of dinosaur interests. So it's a really useful chapter to have in the book, and actually I think kind of expands the scope of the book outwards a bit. So I think it's useful, useful thing to have in there, and it's a really interesting chapter.
I think it is really important when having these conversations, you know, we come at them from a film studies or media studies perspective, but it is important to bring in people who have those other views or those other perspectives on it.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what I try to do with the whole podcast, really, is I try and mix and match the science with the media aspect of things.
I think as well, you know, let's face it, the big draw of Jurassic Park is the dinosaurs themselves, which were sort of facilitated by the digital effects and ILM and the sort of the Stan Winston's animatronics. There are numerous chapters which deal with the sort of the importance of the dinosaurs within the film and their draw, you know, to dinosaur fans as well. So for instance, Ross Garner writes a chapter on dinosaur fandom, Janet Stasia writes about the way that it's sort of embedded within, you know, Jurassic Park is kind of became sort of embedded within a wider culture, and became part of the sort of the media vernacular at the time. So she looks at kind of Jurassic jokes relating to dinosaurs within sort of media, within various newspapers and publications. So the other things that I was interested in with doing with the book is having people think about and write about how Jurassic Park exists outside of its kind of status as a film. So we've got someone writing about theme park rides. Carissa Baker writing about sort of global theme park experiences. Based on sort of Jurassic Park. We've got Alison Whitney writing about the sort of reframing of Jurassic Park as a 3D experience, as the IMAX 3D experience. We've even got, you know, really interesting chapter closing the book about its adaptation as a kind of postmodern theatrical play about a family who sort of recreate scenes from Jurassic Park, which was staged at a festival in sort of mid-2000s. It's written by Catherine Pugh. So there's lots of different sort of, you know, different voices around this. But I think, you know, at the centre of it all are the dinosaurs.
It's definitely a film that has had these kind of widespread cultural effects, and the Jurassic Park portrayal of dinosaurs has kind of become the standard cultural reference for those particular animals, for the Tyrannosaurus and for the Velociraptors and the Dilophosaurus, you know, as much as they don't match up with the real life animals, you know, in a pretty extraordinary way, actually. So it really does have some very strong influence. And there's a lot of debate out there amongst Jurassic fans and dinosaur fans and I guess even paleontologists around the extent to which fair.
That's what Ali's chapter sort of looks to do, is to kind of think about how they're represented in the film as opposed to their sort of, you know, real life kind of dinosaur biology. And so I think that's really interesting as well. I think one of the interesting things about the sort of legacy of the film is that in its wake, you know, there was this kind of dinosaur mania, but also in sort of television as well. So you had documentaries like Walking with Dinosaurs, which employed a kind of, you know, digital, you know, dinosaur experience. You know, you had all these different sort of, you know, global dinosaur experiences, you know, interactive experiences and things. It really did prompt a kind of sort of, you know, global dino mania. which is, I think, key part of its legacy.
I mean, and that's absolutely still going. You know, we just had the Jurassic Park exhibition in Sydney, and currently touring around Australia and New Zealand is a giant Lego exhibition featuring basically life-size dinosaur models built from Lego. So, and in fact, it is Jurassic World branded. It's a Jurassic World exhibition. Yeah. So,
yeah, well, certainly, I think Jurassic World has continued the legacy of Jurassic Park. I mean, it's drawn, even if the story is different or maybe not as successful, it still brings you back to Jurassic Park. And I think, even though Spielberg isn't, you know, he didn't direct any of them, you know, he's embedded within them. There's that kind of, you know, Spielbergian identity there, I think, which I think is important. I mean, for me, what I've loved recently is that I watched it with my 11-year-old daughter. She was nine or ten at the time, who saw it for the first time and loved it. So we sat down together and we watched Jurassic Park. And, I think that's part of the appeal of the new films as well. The idea that parents who kind of sat down with the saw it as a child or as a young person can then sit down with their own young people and sort of experience it again in a kind of new way, which I think is really important.
One thing as well that's probably nice about the franchise is that you get shows like Camp Cretaceous now too, which introduced kids to the dinosaurs in a more wholesome way. You know, even though there are still sort of deaths there, they're shown off screen. They're not shown; they're off screen. So you get a kind of softer introduction for kids.
Absolutely. I think, but having said that, I mean, what kid has not enjoyed Donald Gennaro being eaten on a toilet by a tyrannosaur?
Look, I have to agree. I think I was only 7 when Jurassic Park came out, and I'm pretty sure I saw it at the cinema.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bit that people take away from the film, I think, you know, particularly when you're, the guy gets eaten sitting on a toilet.
Absolutely. But it's an interesting kind of, it's almost played for humor in a way. Like,
oh, it is, yeah.
It's
it
only
is,
a bit later on that you actually get the, I think this was Gennaro, kind of inspecting the wreckage.
Well, there's a chapter on dinosaur violence in the book by Jennifer Schell. I think she mentions the idea that it kind of draws your attention away. I think it softens the violence. It makes it more palatable, I think, those cartoonish moments. Because I know Spielberg, I think, and Crichton too, both kind of said they weren't going to let their young children go and see it when it came out. So I think that was quite interesting.
You got to wonder how much that was playing into the marketing.
Yeah, well, it came with a parental warning. The marketing campaign. So they were clearly aware that it was going to have the potential to cheer kids up.
Finally, I just want to ask one more question, and that is with the speculation that David Culp is returning to pen the franchise's 7th film, what do you think we're going to see in the future of the Jurassic Park franchise?
Oh, we just published these two bloody things. Now they release another one, which...
and barely a year away.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll get there, but
a new Jurassic Park film in less than a year.
Yeah,
I don't know. But what could it entail? I don't know. I was thinking about this earlier. Is it going to go back to is it going to be Jurassic World or is it going to go back to being Jurassic Park?
I think they're giving it a new name based on the We're talking about the internet speculation. They seem to be saying it's going to have a new name.
Oh, really? So it'll be like a third.
Yeah.
A third iteration, to put it in
Malcolm's.
It'll be interesting. I'd be interesting to see, though, what, you know, if they go back to sales of scripts to incorporate any of those ideas in there. There was an idea for a script. I think it was, I may be mistaken about this, but there was an idea for Jurassic Park 3 before it became what it is, in which Alan Grant has snuck back onto the island to protect the dinosaurs and is living a kind of Robinson Crusoe-esque sort of lifestyle on the island, which I think might be quite interesting. I have seen sort of internet mock-ups for posters, in, you know, with a young, very young Dickie Attenborough on them, suggesting that one of the films could go back into the, you know, the history of the Hammond character and his obsession with dinosaurs.
I think that would be an interesting film, but there wouldn't be many dinosaurs, right? We're talking about before he got around to creating them. So only in his imagination. So look, I guess we'll have to see what comes out in Jurassic Park 7, but I'm sure it'll draw the audiences because people do love dinosaurs on the big screen. So Matt Miller, thanks so much. Yeah, no problem at all. I'm looking forward to speaking with some of your contributors to the book, and we'll make sure all the details of the publication and where people can pick it up are in the show notes. Thanks so much.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. That was great. Really enjoyed that.
The next interview I have for you is Peter Kramer. Peter's chapter in the Jurassic Park book is called Rebellious Creations, Monstrous Animals and Unnatural Disasters, the Jurassic Park Franchise and Box Office Hit Patterns. Peter, you describe Jurassic Park as a family adventure movie, part of which is concerned with subject matter associated with childhood, like dinosaurs. What is it about dinosaurs on screen that you think appeals to such huge audiences like we see for Jurassic Park?
Well, I had to think about this a little bit when I first received your question. Because to be perfectly honest, I just took it as a given that dinosaurs are something that children are interested in. And also, I guess, to the adults that the children grow up into. But I haven't really explored the question why that might be the case. So I am pretty sure there is a literature out there amongst child psychologists or, you know, media scholars who deal particularly with children. And also, of course, the wider appeal of dinosaurs. I'm sure there is a special social science literature about it, which I don't know. So I have to admit that straight away. But I can speculate a little bit. I mean, obviously, also in the context of your podcast and the whole project, extinction seems to be an important element. Now, I'm not sure whether that makes any sense. Well, from what age onwards does the concept of a species going extinct make sense to a child? I'm not sure. So that would be something for the child psychologists to investigate. You know, the knowledge about extinction. There's also, of course, the whole question of between extinct and not existing in the first place. I had to think about dragons. You know, children seem to be fascinated by dragons, which at some point they know don't exist. But have they gone extinct? Did they used to exist? So it seems to me that there's a lot of connections there. But the impact of extinction as a concept, I'm not sure when that starts kicking in with children. Obviously, it's there for adults, but where it kicks in for children, I have no idea at what age. The other thing is that I guess it's not dinosaurs in general. It seems to me that, going by my own experiences, it's the T-Rex, really. That is the fascination. And I think there the connection with fire spewing dragons and all that. So these are ferocious, dangerous animals. So why children would be interested in that, again, who knows? I mean, ask a child psychologist. Yeah. The other thing I thought about was that we encounter as children, I think if you're lucky enough, in my generation, coming from provincial Germany, it wasn't a given that you would go to a museum of natural history and see a huge T-Rex skeleton. That was not a given. But I think for a lot of children these days, or even in the 90s when Jurassic Park came out, that was pretty much a given. You would do that at some point. Mm-hmm. So I think it's got something to do with either the skeleton or the more full reconstruction of a dinosaur. Of course, the skeleton has the element of death built in. So that's intriguing. That's intriguing. Yeah. So maybe extinction doesn't make any sense to a young child, but a skeleton and the association with death probably does. So I don't know. It's got to do with large beings that are dangerous to you. Maybe, you know, projection of the image you have of your parents at their worst. And it has to do with death, I think.
I have seen that link to the notion of parents and the kind of unknowable world out there. I think my very first guest on this podcast, all the way back, Bria Sachs, had a book in which he described that exact aspect, actually, this kind of adult world, maybe, that dinosaurs represent for children. What you are an expert in, though, is cinema. And yes. And the trends in and around cinema. And so in your chapter for the Jurassic Park book, this is what you really do focus on. How do you think Jurassic Park impacted or shaped American cinema? Did it launch any new trends, or what impact did it leave on the cinema?
Well, I think the most obvious one is an indirect one. Well, it's direct on some level, but indirect in another, because it's so self-consciously about CGI. So it is about photorealistic, computer-generated imagery. And that had existed before. And actually, the film I would team Jurassic Park up with is Terminator 2 Judgment Day, where photorealistic CGI was used very successfully in one particular character. And so I think that's the main impact is, and Jurassic Park is very self-conscious about, you know, how it reveals. The big reveal of the first dinosaur images are very self-conscious in terms of people looking at something and being completely awed by it, which is, you know, in a sense, modeling what we are supposed to do in front of the screen. The people on the screen do it for us. Not that that was necessary, but, you know, it's just one of those things that filmmakers do. They model our behavior, our response, or our hoped-for response on screen through the characters. But I would say it's CGI that, in a sense, not only the possibilities of using CGI, but to the extent to which you can reshape whole cinematic worlds through CGI, completely transform them. I think, now, of course, at some point, a lot of CGI is really trivial. It's like, you know, you used to do an old wire trick, and you just use CGI to take the wire out. Mm-hmm. You know, you just cleaned up the image. So there's a lot of computer manipulation of images, which is completely invisible, and it's not so spectacular or anything. Stephen Prince, I think, has written about this brilliantly. But the kind of CGI we're talking about with Jurassic Park is the attempt to create images which are absolutely photorealistic, but seem unbelievable or otherworldly or fantastic or whatever. But they're absolutely photorealistically real as well. So I think that seems to me what Jurassic Park helped to And then, of course, it gets to the point, within a few years, it gets to the point where one of the websites, is it the Numbers? I can't remember which one. So they used to have categories, animation and live action. And then they had the category hybrid. And frankly, every film now is, every big movie is a hybrid. Because it's there's some live action in it. There's lots of computer-generated manipulation or imagery in it. So, you know, so that trend towards hybrid cinema, where live action, even in the broadest possible definition of live action, you know, that something physically is in front of the camera, even if it's some trick or whatever. Even the broadest possible definition of live action doesn't apply to most movies anymore, most big movies anymore. Yeah. So, and I think that's the shift. But I said it was the double whammy of Terminator 2 in 91 and Jurassic Park in 93. It's that double whammy that made it possible. By the way, I probably have to make one exception. Apparently, Christopher Nolan, who is by far the most successful filmmaker, not only of today, possibly of all time, he apparently doesn't use CGI. I don't know how he does it, but, you know, one would have to read up on that separately, you know. So there are forms of traditional trick special effects cinema that you can still maintain. But I think by and large, it's all films are hype, all big films, action, science fiction, fantasy, and so on. They're hybrid films of they're computer animated and live action. Yeah, so I think that's the main trend.
Even television really is a sort of hybrid art form nowadays.
I mean, at a certain point, and of course, now we have the whole debate about artificial intelligence, you know. So, you know, soon enough, you know, you can probably, I don't know, you can ask a computer to create an action scene in the style of Michael Bay or something.
Yeah.
You
know what I mean? I mean, we are recording this like 3 days after OpenAI released their Sora model, which is literally text to video. And I've seen a lot of speculation. I'm not expecting you to have a lot of insight on that because I didn't put it to you in advance. But, a lot of people online are debating about the role of that tool in filmmaking and whether it's likely to do exactly what you said.
Well, the thing is that... I don't think you needed a film to demonstrate all this. But, you know, because I've done a lot of work on Pixar, and that's a very convoluted story, and it has to do with computer animation, but animation that looks like animation, not animation that looks like photorealistic imagery. But there was no doubt that was going to happen eventually, but, you know, Toy Story came out in 1995, the first full-length, fully computer. Well, actually, they're never fully computer-generated. You know that. The voices aren't computer-generated.
Oh, the voices aren't, of course, yeah.
So, and I don't know about the sound effects, whether they're computer-generated or traditional sound studio, you know, using.
Is there a Foley artist? I'm sure there is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an interesting thing, that you would think it much easier to computer-generate a voice than an image, but they haven't done that, as far as I'm aware.
There's some really, again... You know, you're probably not across this, but there's some really interesting work, academic work, looking at things called, there's a system called Vocaloid, which literally is a voice generator sort of system that's widely used for content creation in Japan. And you get these kind of generated or synthetic idols, you know, these pop performers who are entirely generated, including their including their voice. So, but even then, I think, you know, a lot of them are based on a real set of recordings from a real person, and then they're kind of modulated.
The question of intellectual property rights, which, you know, I guess the Screen Actors Guild strike and the Writers Guild strike were partly about. But I don't think you need a Jurassic Park for this to happen. And you didn't need Pixar, although Pixar, when you look at the development of the company, is such an unlikely story. But then so is Netflix, and so was Amazon. So in a way, these are all completely unlikely stories until they have happened. And then you think, of course it had to happen. But until it did happen, it was so completely unlikely that any of these projects would succeed. They are, I guess, Jurassic Park is different. If you have Steven Spielberg, most successful, up to this point, the most successful filmmaker of all time, I guess, adapting a best-selling novel and using cutting-edge technology, I think you could be pretty sure that that would be a hit. So that wasn't the kind of unpredictable thing. That was as surefire as you can get. So in that sense, it was important. But I think the overall development would have happened anyway. Now, the other thing that one might want to say is certain kind of disaster, a certain kind of catastrophe. Now, disaster movies were big in the 70s, but they also were taken to another level in fantasy and science fiction with Star Wars, a whole planet explodes. In Superman as well, a whole planet explodes. And then what is it that California falls into the ocean or something? But that's a different kind of disaster. And I think Jurassic Park goes back to an older model of disaster movie. But the question is, did it actually become very successful? That kind of, it's a smallish group of people in a limited location that they can't get away from. And then some force, usually of nature or of man-made, reconstructed nature, breaks out and brings about death and destruction. I'm not sure whether, because the next big, the really, really big films are films like Armageddon, where it isn't. The confined location is Earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And same in Independence Day. So I'm not sure whether, the revival of certain kind of large-scale destruction movies at the top of the charts. I'm only ever talking about the top of the charts because if you look at the overall output of Hollywood, who knows? And it's hundreds of films every year. How could you possibly know, what all these films are? But when you look at the top of the charts, since the late 70s, large-scale destruction, really large-scale destruction was quite prominent. I think it becomes more prominent in the 90s. But Jurassic Park is more, I think Matt talked about this, more a throwback to the more localized disaster movies of the 70s. So I'm not sure whether it exerted such a big influence in that respect.
That's a really interesting logic because I fully agree with you. One of the challenges that the Jurassic filmmakers have had in their sequels is not telling the same story again and again and again. The Lost World and Jurassic Park 3 and Jurassic World and to a certain extent Fallen Kingdom and even Dominion all told the same story, which is basically the dinosaurs rampaging against a small group of humans in a relatively confined location. Notwithstanding the Tyrannosaurus running through San Diego at the end of The Lost World. But those things are kind of, they've struggled to break out from the island in a sense, even though they've kind of wanted to, but they've struggled the filmmakers to find a way. But the series still is a big draw card. It's a billion-dollar series, I think. Globally, all of the films make the films on average have made $1 billion. And there's now a new one expected in 2025, which comes pretty soon after Dominion. Do you think it's a film franchise that can continue to be at the top of the box office, or is it going to struggle against these other big film franchises?
To be perfectly honest, I had lost track of it. I didn't like the second one very much, nor the third one. And I didn't feel the third one making any impact whatsoever. Although I was surprised when I did the research, I thought, oh, actually, you're surprisingly successful.
Yeah.
And I would have never thought you could revive it. So I think this is one of those franchises that I thought was, you know, diminishing returns very quickly and then it's gone. That they revived it. Mm-hmm. I have had no idea that you could do that. But then again, you know, how can you make a sequel to Top Gun? You know what I mean? What's that all about? And it's good. I didn't like the first one, but I really liked the second one. And it's really good. And it was super successful. Who would have thought? Or the most extreme example recently, that Avatar 2, which I didn't like at all, although I loved the first one, you know, is by, you know, any standards, I guess the third most successful film of all time now at the global box office, not in, adjusted for inflation. So who knows? I mean, I think there used to be rules, like a sequel always makes less money than the film before. That doesn't apply to James Bond series. The James Bond series that had a different logic, because it wasn't a continuing story until recently. It's
more serialized.
Until recently, I think the Daniel Craig one. The way I understand it, I mean, I'm not a big Bond fan, but the Daniel Craig ones were connected. At least the first two were closely connected. So there used to be rules about sequels, but they stopped. For example, Matrix 2 made more money than Matrix 1, and I thought, this is impossible.
Mm.
How can this be? You know, because the second one, you have to have seen the first one many times to have any chance to understand the second one. But then you have to say, oh, yeah, because it's of DVD. Or whatever, you know, people bought the DVD who hadn't seen the first film. They watched it before they watched the second, whatever. So there were all kinds of rules which have been broken. And the more we look at it, the more the rules we thought they existed have gone out of the window. So I make absolutely no prediction. Now even the Marvel thing, the rule of Marvel seems to come to an end. You know, I didn't see that coming. I did not see that coming.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one, because it felt like this juggernaut that was just unstoppable. But now, a lot of those films are really struggling. You noted in your chapter that lots of those really popular films feature humanity's creations, and you've already mentioned the disaster film, but you also pointed out things like robots and monsters turning against the creators as a sort of subset of those disaster films. Why do you think that attracts audiences? Why are those successful?
Well, I think there's two reasons. First of all, that's what myth and religion is all about, isn't it? I mean, challenging humanity's challenging the gods and getting whacked for it, you know? I mean, I don't know much about Greek myth, but I think there's a fair amount of Greek myth where this kind of thing happens. Except, of course, the one that is very prominent right now because of Oppenheimer, Prometheus. He was punished, not so much the humans. The one who stole the fire from the gods and gave it to the humans was punished. But usually it's the humans doing something naughty and getting punished, like being kicked out of paradise and things like that. You know, minor things like that. So that's both Greek myth and religion. You know, building the Tower of Babel and all these kinds of things. So I think it's deeply rooted in the way human beings have always conceived of the world around them. There are higher forces at work, and you better be in harmony with them, because otherwise they're going to get you. So it's not about creations, but it is about any kind of challenge to those higher forces is dangerous. So I think that is so deeply rooted in human beings. But the other thing, of course, that I point out in my chapter has to do with starting in the United States, apparently, although it's difficult to get global opinion polls. But in the United States, within a few years, in the mid to late 60s, when they first started asking about environmental issues in opinion polls, it immediately became a very important issue. It's astonishing because, you know, we're still struggling with environmental issues. But in the late 60s, everyone was talking about it and opinion. It's very important. So it starts in the States and then it spreads around the world. This kind of awareness of environmental destruction, that what we do to the environment, as it were, will be done to us ultimately. And I try to say, is it coincidence that some of these mega hits appear around similar issues to do with disasters, natural disasters or unnatural disasters, or creations turning against the creators, or monstrous animals? That a lot of that happens in Hollywood cinema at the top of the charts, and interestingly, even more pronounced on television, the top-rated films on television in the United States in the 70s, many of them are of that kind. And yeah. So I would say, well, that would be a strange coincidence, but it's a tricky one to establish causality here. There's something going on whereby, for all kinds of reasons, there's a heightened awareness that modern societies use up resources in a way which is not sustainable. They destroy things that they depend on in the process of, you know, sustaining themselves. And that awareness runs parallel to movies that, you know, in many different ways. I mean, Planet of the Apes is an interesting one, because you only find out at the end, nuclear war, sure, you know, whatever. But actually, in the first one, you don't even find out it's nuclear war. I think you have to wait for the second one. But you can guess in the first one that it must have been a nuclear war. That's, of course, the other thing that goes back to the mid-40s or the late-40s, the awareness of the threat of nuclear war, which would be the ultimate environmental catastrophe.
I guess that's the thing, isn't it? The environmental concerns have shifted and changed over time. So, you know, the direct concerns about radiation, but then also we had things about land clearing and sort of visible air pollution was another that kind of became very common. And now climate change is the permeating environmental concern, I think, for most people. And something like Don't Look Up really takes that as its central metaphor, even when the natural disaster in the film is a comet, you know, something that we couldn't avoid as such, but we choose to ignore it instead of preparing. So
I think it's a mixture, absolutely. It's a mixture of deep-rooted mythological religious themes. There's the overarching sense since the late 40s that a nuclear war could end everything. And then there's the more specific concern, which comes, I mean, the book that is always said to have launched the modern environmental movement in the States, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, equates the effect of pesticides and insecticides with nuclear radiation or radioactivity. Mm. And it makes very clear the connection between the two. And so the modern environmental movement is informed by, you know, deep mythological religious themes, by nuclear anxiety, but also just the reality of, you know, polluted rivers and air and everything, which became so obvious. And there were a few disasters in the late 60s in the States, but then it spreads around the world. And you know, this awareness and the fact that it is human created, even with climate change, despite all the denialism, by and large, the world's population, representative surveys have found that people say, it's happening. Yeah, and it's probably mostly or largely to do with human activity.
I think all of this became the norm worldwide over a few decades, this kind of view. And so the kinds of films we've been talking about, in a sense, play on that. They reflect it, or they heighten it, or, you know, or provide cathartic release. I don't know. But in so many different ways, they do that. And but I think the specific question about Jurassic Park is a slightly different one. And I haven't really, in a different context, I've thought about these things, but not with Jurassic Park itself.
Yeah.
So I think Michael Crichton is a very interesting figure. And it is, I was surprised when I looked up, you know, on Google Scholar, Google Books, you know, what had been written about him. There wasn't that much that I could find. And certainly not many overviews of his oeuvre. You know, he's also co-creator of ER, one of, you know, the best television series ever.
Yeah.
You know, he's a seminal figure, but
He's probably underappreciated, absolutely. In terms of academically underappreciated, yeah, I think you're exactly right. Yeah,
because I think academia has problems with these kinds of... He's not out and out trash, you know. He's sort of middle brow, and I think academics hate the middle brow the most. If it's upper trash, yeah, whatever, we can deal with it. If it's high literature, yeah, that's good. But, you know, anything somewhere in the middle with footnotes, you know what I mean? With footnotes, he has endless footnotes in some of his novels. So I think the Jurassic Park books. There are something to do with playing God and interfering in creation, and that backfires, I guess.
And just to circle back again slightly, your comment about the attraction of religious titles and themes, even though it's not in, it's a theme in Jurassic Park, but actually they really foreground that in the title of The Lost World. You know, that's almost a reference to Eden. And then later on in Fallen Kingdom, that's obviously a fairly clear reference to humans again leaving Eden and being fallen creatures, I guess, within God. And then you get Dominion, which is again to me quite clearly a very loaded religiously connotated term. As well. So even in Jurassic Park, we see that explicitly, not just inherently in the themes, that notion of the Greek epics and the religious epics and those kinds of things playing out.
That's what you would expect. That's one of my, not theories, but one of my conclusions about American cinema, because the World Value Surveys, which started with a limited group of countries, I think in the 70s, and then at some point it covered most of the world's population. They show very clearly that religiousness tends to go down when the GDP goes up, as it were. So there is a negative correlation between living standards and religiosity, and the one where this is least in evidence is the United States. So the United States remained a fairly deeply religious society for much longer than you would expect. So although filmmakers in Hollywood come from anywhere in the world, some of the key decision makers, studio heads, and also most the writers are actually, I think the writers of top movies are more consistently American than the directors or the actors or whatever. So I think there is something that is very close to Americans, even if you're not religious yourself,
yeah,
you know, you're bound to pick up on the religiosity of the surrounding society. So for no good reason whatsoever, you make a Terminator sequel and you just say, well, let's call it Judgment Day.
Yeah.
Or let's make an asteroid movie. Let's call it Armageddon. You know what I mean? It's not even that you mean anything by it, but it's just so deeply rooted in that particular society, not just in, you know, the West in general or humanity in general. It's so particularly alive still in the United States that I think these things happen. But I think that gives Hollywood a particular strength, because Hollywood is more inclined to put in these mythological religious dimensions than filmmakers in most other countries.
And it becomes it becomes a kind of soft power wedge of American soft power then as well.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. Absolutely, yeah. And but I don't mean it in a sort of negative way. I just mean it. But of course, you know, when you look around, because I'm very interested in Chinese blockbusters, and of course you know that in The Wandering Earth, it's the Chinese who save the day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's no longer the Americans, and I don't know what religious framework there is, but I can't see much. Much familiar things, but maybe you have to think about it again. And the three body problem will be very interesting because, you know, it was made in written in China, and the original there's two series, Chinese adaptations of the first and second novel. But now, of course, the Netflix has remade it, and I think there the Americans are saying, "Hey, hang on a moment, we can't leave this to the Chinese," you know.
Peter, we have ranged well beyond Isla Nublar and well beyond the dinosaurs, but it has been an absolutely fascinating discussion, kicked off by your chapter, the Jurassic Park franchise and box office hit patterns. Thank you very much for joining me on Fossils and Fiction.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much to Matt Melia and Peter Kramer for their fascinating conversations. Honestly, Peter and I talked for a very long time about global cinema, but a lot of it got so far away from the point of this podcast that I just had to do a cut. Perhaps it's time for a Patreon where I can release those extended interviews. We'll see. Thanks so much for joining me. First episode of Fossils and Fiction for 2024. Just a reminder, this is part one of the chat about the Jurassic Park book edited by Matt Melia. We'll have the next part in coming weeks. Take care. Thanks for listening. Find more info on the web at fossilsfiction.co and across social media. Follow and rate us on your favourite podcasting platform. If you have a story to share on the podcast, please get in touch. The theme music is Sonora by Lucas Moreno.